Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight was born in Detroit and grew up in Marshalltown, Iowa, and Grayling, Michigan. We've listened to him for 40 years announce Michigan State football games, and for 42 years do the Detroit Pistons basketball games with his famous trademark sayings such as,
"Don't look now, but we've got a two-point game."
A 2010 inductee of the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame, his name, George Blaha. And we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Pasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Pasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to George Blaha, who for the last 42 years has been the radio and television play-by-play voice of the Detroit Pistons. George, what an honor to have you back.
It's an honor to be with you, Jack. I love the program.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Sure. I think an idyllic childhood. After spending a few years in Detroit when my dad was here for his surgical training as a University of Iowa Medical School graduate, we went back to central Iowa, his home area, and the town I was grew up in, Marshalltown, had about 25,000 people. We had great demographics there, meaning we weren't sheltered to the point where there were no African Americans or no other kinds of minorities. We had a little bit of everything, nice melting pot of people. And we all got along. Whatever I saw was all very, very positive. And at the University of Iowa, where I attended football games as a youngster, it was very obvious that the Hawkeye fans were open-minded. We had a black captain in 1953, Calvin Jones. He wasn't a co-captain or a tri-captain. He was the captain of the Iowa Hawkeyes. In fact, he was the first African-American to win the Outland Trophy. And we as kids, we didn't know that. All we knew was he was a star for our Iowa Hawkeyes. So that and a local semi-pro baseball team that had a baseball school, let us play baseball all summer, and eventually being a caddy at the country club, even though my dad belonged there. Those kind of memories you can't ever take away from me. And the endless games, whether we played basketball at somebody's hoop or baseball or football down the street, all summer long. More fun than you could imagine. And then coming home to a happy home, it was great for me.
You mentioned idyllic times. You earned a bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Notre Dame. And talking about football games, where were you for the game of the century, November 19th, 1966?
Well, I had I'd already graduated from the university the previous spring, and I was biding my time until I went to graduate school of business at the University of Michigan. I was going to go to law school at Notre Dame, had been accepted, and I was proud to have been accepted. But my thought was, you know, in the end, I want to be in broadcasting. I really don't want to practice law, and it's unfair of me to take up a space in that law school. So I'm going to move on and do something different. And so it left me a semester to get out and work before I went on to graduate school. So I was working at a bank in South Bend. But believe me, we made our way to East Lansing for the game. My future father-in-law had some tickets, and I sat with him. And my friend Ray Flynn, who was a middleweight boxing champ in Notre Dame, and a guy named Dick Shimrack, wonderful guy who had been a scholarship football player at Notre Dame from Ambridge, PA. I remember that. And we could feel the hitting up in row 40. Believe me, it was an amazing football game.
Notre Dame had a coach named Ara Parseghian that we lost a while last summer. Tell us about Ara Parseghian.
Well, in my opinion, he put Notre Dame back on the map. He took a football program that was dormant at the time, really, and many people thought would never rise again, and brought them immediately back. His first year there, he moved guys around. Moved Jack Snow from wing back to wide receiver. He brought a quarterback off the bench who'd never won a letter, John Hewitt. And John Hewitt won the Heisman Trophy that year in 1964. And he picked up his Heisman Trophy before he picked up his first Notre Dame letter. Era had a great understanding of who the players were and where they should play. And he was so inspirational. That Notre Dame team took the field with great confidence, great vigor, and a certain sense of team that you don't find under very many coaches. And those coaches who can bring that out of their players win plenty of ball games, just like Era did.
Speaking of legendary people, Notre Dame was led by a priest by the name of Father Theodore Hesburgh.
Well, Father Hesburgh and Ara Parseghian, to me, did me wonderful favors in my life. Because, you know, I've been in broadcasting for many, many years. As you said, 42 years. It's hard to believe, broadcasting Piston games. I started broadcasting Michigan State football actually before that. And it's a very competitive field. If you don't have a certain amount of confidence, you probably get run over before you get a chance to try and climb up the ladder. And I always felt like the fact that I graduated from Notre Dame made me feel a certain confidence that helped me get ahead in this business. And over the years, as I've thought about it, the two gentlemen who did that for me were Father Hesburgh, who, before I got to Notre Dame, while I was at Notre Dame, and of course after I graduated, continued to make Notre Dame a greater university, and now obviously one of the great universities in the world. And Era brought football back, and football's important to Notre Dame, and he did it the right way. Was never even a thought that anything was going on that shouldn't have been going on. And last summer, as you mentioned, Jack, when Era passed away, I felt like I wanted to be there at his funeral mass. And I knew that it was probably going to be a sellout. So George Gedecky, a good friend of mine who played for Era, and matter of fact was just named to the All-Era team after Era's passing, told me what the plans for the weekend were. And I knew that the funeral mass started at 2. He said all the football players are going to be there at least by 1. We're afraid we won't get a seat. And so I thought, well, if they're going to be there at 1, I better be there at 12:30. So we sat there for an hour and a half waiting for it to begin. And on the way to Sacred Heart Basilica, we stopped at the Notre Dame Cemetery to visit the gravesite of Father Hesburgh. Those two men deserve all my thanks, and they deserve all the blessings in the world. Matter of fact, speaking of blessings, if you ever shared a meal with Father Hesburgh, he would start it with his Chilean grace. Here it is. Dear Lord, give bread to those who have hunger, and to those of us who have bread, give a hunger for justice. That was Father Hesburgh, a member of two civil rights commissions under two different American presidents. And he and John Hanna, the great Michigan State president, were on the Civil Rights Commission together and became very good friends. As a matter of fact, after the 10-10 tie in East Lansing, Father Hesburgh stayed overnight at Father Hanna's home. And they both said, we were thick as thieves.
We're talking to George Blaha. In 1998 and 2007, he was named Michigan Sports Broadcaster of the Year. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and with George Blaha. George, let's go back. 1976. WJR had a young man named Frank Beckman who was in charge of hiring somebody to do the Pistons play-by-play. And it came down to you and another finalist. And Frank hired you. Who was the other finalist? And tell us about that story.
I found out years later it was Bob Costas.
Beckman said, I chose the guy with the prettier face.
I don't think he did that. But, you know, I think Tom Campbell, who a great newscaster here at WJR, deserves all the credit in the world for that as well. Tom and I had worked together briefly at another station in town, a beautiful music station, WQTE, and got to be the kind of buddies that discuss sports. And he said, man, you know a lot about sports. He said, Now that I'm a JR, I'm going to mention to Frank Beckman that if there's ever an opening over here, he should consider you. And Frank said, well, Tom, I don't have a sports day-in, day-out sportscaster opening, but what we are looking for is somebody to do the Pistons. And so, you know, foolishly I applied for that, even though I really probably wasn't experienced enough to take over that job. And matter, I'd done Michigan State football. That was my entree, I felt. But the only basketball tape I had was the tape of the Class B state championship game from a year or two before that, Holt against Muskegon Heights. As a matter of fact, when I was doing a Michigan State appearance in Muskegon a couple years back, I said, I want to thank everybody from this area because you all helped me get my job broadcasting the Pistons. So Frank listened to my tape. He said, you know, the football tape's fine, but I really do have to listen to a basketball tape. So I sent him the high school tape. And he told me in, I want to say, May or June, that he had a lot of tapes, but that I was the leader. And I thought, well, I'm the leader in the clubhouse at a major golf tournament. I'm sure there are going to be guys all summer long taking a shot at this. I hope it holds up. So I called him again in like August and said, Frank, I don't mean to bug you, but am I still the leader? Yeah, you are, and I'll let you know. So at that point, I didn't bother him again. But I got to give Frank an awful lot of credit. He's always been a guy who's confident in his decision-making ability and his convictions. And he was convinced I'd be the right guy for this job. And the fans were kind enough to allow me to do it for a few years. And so here we are.
All right, your first Pistons game, George Blaha, was in Cobo Hall, October 23rd, 1976. Tell us about that night.
Nerve-wracking. But Tom Hemingway was doing the games with me as well. Matter of fact, we decided we would share the games that year. So, and Tom had done the games before, so we had Tom do quarters 1 and 4. I thought that was only respectful of me, so I did 2 and 3. But actually, I think it was a good deal to do 2 and 3 because you could get into a rhythm a little better. So I'm getting ready for the game to start anyway, and I see Bob Lanier and Wes Unseld walk out for the opening tip. I wouldn't call it a jump ball. Those guys both jumped a little, but Bob better than Wes. But still, these were what we call giant pivot men and two of the all-time great NBA big men. And I thought, man, I better buckle up my seatbelt. This is a man's game, and I better get ready for it. I'll tell you one thing. It really got my attention, and I understood how good the players were right away. It was so exciting for me to do that game. I was living in the Lansing area at the time, and so after the game, I got my car to drive home. The next thing I knew, I was in Grosse Pointe because I was pretty distracted, obviously. Then I realized, okay, I think now it's going to be even a longer drive back to Lansing, but it was one of the great drives of my life, really. I'll never forget it.
Speaking of all-time greats, we recently lost two legends, Dick Enberg and Keith Jackson, famous for Oh My, and Whoa, Nelly.
Exactly.
Talk about Enberg and Keith Jackson.
Well, I'm reading Dick Enberg's book right now. A Notre Dame classmate of mine met him last summer at a charity golf outing and got him to sign a book for me. And I'm reading the book. It's wonderful about his days in Armada and then moving to California and the great events that he did such a wonderful job covering. Everything from college basketball to pro football to Wimbledon to golf.
The Olympics.
I'm telling you, this guy, in my opinion, was the most versatile sports broadcaster ever, at least during my lifetime, without question. And a very kind, unassuming guy. When I met him once, I said, you know, you can do anything. He said, I'm probably a jack of all trades and a master of none. I said, I don't know. Don't be so tough on yourself. You're better, way better than that. And as far as Keith Jackson's concerned, he was the voice in your ear for college football for most of our lives, many of us, many of my buddies anyway. And if you've never really dialed in on Keith Jackson doing college football, you don't know what you've missed.
Speaking of college football, you've been doing MSU football for over 40 years, and Coach Mark D'Antonio, year after year, doesn't get any five-star kids, really few, if any, four-star. He gets these three-star kids, and he turns them into winners. How?
He's an amazing guy, and he's so understated that you really have to know him and be around him and be around his staff and see how he interacts with his players to understand how he has such great success. Number one, he's a heck of a football coach. You know, he's a guy who was a defensive backs coach for Nick Saban, who was – that's Nick's area of expertise, by the way. So that certainly helped Mark. And then whoever coaches DBs, defensive backs, I should say, under Mark, not only learns what Mark knows, but what Nick knows. And Harlan Barnett's a classic example. He just went to Florida State as defensive coordinator. But I bring up Harlan Barnett because on this staff that Coach D'Antonio has at Michigan State are a lot of excellent football coaches who are very loyal soldiers. And there's a certain unity at Michigan State. There's no I in team. We all know that. And if certain people, whether they're coaches or whether they're players, are too much into themselves and not into the team, you won't have the kind of success that you have if you're unified. And I think all the coaches and the players take their cue from Mark D'Antonio. This guy, he's the furthest thing possible from an egomaniac. He's a common, ordinary, decent, caring guy. I have I've told his wife, Becky, a number of times after our coaches' radio shows that air here on WJR, that these people have come up lines and lines of people to get things signed and take a picture. And he is kind and gracious to all of them. And I said, Becky, you know, this is really one of America's great football coaches. And he couldn't be any more kind or any more gracious. You should be proud of him. And that's how I feel about Mark.
We're talking to George Blaha. When we come back, we'll start talking about his 40-plus years with the Pistons. And I'm Jack Pasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Pasula. Through two team owners, three arenas, three world championships, 20 coaches, thousands of games, and countless more players, George Blaha's been the one consistent with the Pistons. For decades, they were owned by Mr. D, Bill Davidson.
Wonderful guy. We all miss him. And Tom Gores has paid him a number of compliments because he understands what Bill Davidson did to make the Detroit Pistons the entity that they are today. But you know, you could go all the way back to his days at the University of Michigan with his buddy Oscar Feldman, and they were sports fans, and always felt like, hey, if we ever owned a team, well, we'd trade this guy or we'd start this guy. You know, all sports fans do that. And suddenly, Mr. Davidson owned the Detroit Pistons, and he made Oscar his general manager, and they did just fine for a while. But finally, he decided, hey, we really better bring a basketball guy in here to operate the Pistons, and they made an amazing choice with Jack McCloskey, a great hard-edged coach from Penn, who was a service veteran. And then he turned around and hired Chuck Daly to be the Pistons coach, and we had an unbelievable run. The Bad Boys are a team that any sports fan in the Detroit area loves, and throughout Michigan, they're still loved. Throughout the country, they might be loathed in some areas, but believe me, you know who they are. You know who the characters were on that team. And the Bad Boys were absolutely amazing. And, you know, my goodness, you got to admit, if you're George Blaha, can you imagine what they've done for my career? From a team that I think the aficionados all cared about, and we had some wonderful players back in the day, the great Dave Bing, the great Bob Lanier, they're still on the short list of the best who ever played for the Detroit Pistons or ever played in the NBA. They're both Hall of Famers. But when the Bad Boys finally hit it and started to win games and challenge for championships and then win championships, they took it to a whole different level. And we had everybody in metropolitan Detroit and all their sons and daughters and wives and grandmothers and mother-in-laws and father-in-laws, they all wanted tickets. And they all wanted to watch or listen to the game. So those guys did amazing things for me, led by Isaiah Thomas and Bill Laimbeer and Vinnie Johnson and Joe Dumars and all the rest.
You've said on numerous occasions that you believe that Isaiah, pound for pound, one of the greatest that it was ever on a basketball court.
And I still feel that way. Julius Erving said something along those lines at one point. Chuck Daly certainly believed that. And you don't win those championships without Isaiah. He'd be the first to tell you he couldn't win those championships by himself. But if you're going to take anybody away from that team and make them a team that might not be capable of winning a championship, it would be number 11. You had to have him on that team to win those titles. But he had a lot of help. And Chuck Daly once said, when one of his confidants said, you know, Chuck, you were the guy. You were the reason we won those championships. Chuck said, oh, no, hold on here. He said, first of all, you don't win without number 11. And that's Isaiah. And clearly, you don't win without Bill Laimbeer, who did all the dirty work and took all the heat from all the fans and all the arenas all over the country. And then he said, now, let me tell you something. Vinnie Johnson accepting his role as an off-the-bench player behind two Hall of Fame guards, as it turned out, Isaiah and Joe Dumars, made all the difference in the world of that team as well. They went searching for a power forward for a while, finally found a great one in Rick Mahorn. He made a great deal of difference. The two great athletes that Jack McCloskey later drafted, Dennis Rodman and John Sally, made this team very hard to beat. Jack made a trade for James Edwards, and a very, very difficult guy to cover. Gave you instant offense and a big guy who sometimes had to be, in fact, most of the time had to be double-teamed inside. So there were a number of guys. I'm probably going to leave somebody out. The great small forwards that we had, Kelly Trepuka, Adrian Dantley, and Mark Aguirre, all sensational players. And that was a team that, if you really look at that group, you see that Jack McCloskey, who we lost last summer, and some of us went to the South to bury him, and he's going to be missed. But he drafted Isaiah Thomas and Joe Dumars and Dennis Rodman. He drafted three Hall of Famers, and only one near the top of the draft. Joe, toward the lower half of round one, and Dennis Rodman way toward the end of round one or the beginning of round two. And all those other guys that I just mentioned, he traded for them, and he also drafted Kelly Trepiuka, who certainly was a breath of fresh air around here when he first came to the team.
The second dynasty, led by, arguably, Chauncey.
You know, the funny thing about that team is you could say arguably led by Ben Wallace also. And the best player on the team, talent-wise, probably Rasheed Wallace. And Chauncey's backcourt mate, Rip Hamilton, tremendous, tremendous guy, was on a Hall of Fame ballot. And the glue guy was Tayshaun Prince. There was a starting five there that was very, very difficult to beat. They were united. That's like a good football team that you're not going to – they might bend, but they're not going to break. And that was that basketball team. And you got to give Joe Dumars all the credit in the world. He put them together. I don't know if anybody will ever be able to do that again, but kudos to Joe. That was his team, his handpicked team. And with Rick Carlisle turning things around here and then Larry Brown winning the title, it was great to see another championship trophy delivered to Detroit.
Combining Michigan State and the NBA, talk about Magic.
Magic Johnson? Well, he was a guy who changed the game, transformed the game. He made it cool to pass the basketball. There was a time when if you didn't score, who were you? And not only that, he showed guys who were, you know, 6'7", 6'8", 6'9", that you better be able to handle the ball, and you can play other positions. You don't have to stay around the basket for the rest of your life. You can play outside. And when Magic was a schoolboy at Everett High School in Lansing, and we'd watch him play, he would defend, get the rebound, dribble all the way to front forecourt, hand the ball to one of the guards, and then go inside and post up, or move to the corner and wait for the ball, or he'd come outside to get it and then make a play. You could tell then this was a do-it-all guy. And that smile of his, that's worth $1 million or more.
All right, arguably the greatest ever, in my opinion, Michael.
Michael Jordan was a guy that only got booed here in the Detroit area. And we're kind of proud of that, to tell you the truth, because of that rivalry with the Chicago Bulls. There was never any love lost between the Pistons and the Bulls. You know, the Celtics were the Pistons' roadblock to an NBA championship. You can't get out of the East if you can't win the Eastern Conference Championship, and you can't win the Eastern Conference Championship if you don't beat the Boston Celtics. So Larry Bird, Robert Parrish, Kevin McHale, Danny Ainge, Dennis Johnson, those guys were the guys that the Pistons felt like they had to get through. And there wasn't a lot of love lost there, but there was respect there. I think the Pistons felt like when they were the roadblock for the Bulls didn't respect them as much as they would have liked. So, therefore, it didn't end well when the Bulls finally did get by an older Piston team in 1991 with not many handshakes and not a lot of farewells and good lucks. But you got to give that Chicago team credit and Michael credit. He had to pay to get by the Pistons. He was knocked to the floor more times than you can count by the Bad Boys, and he had the bruises to prove it, and therefore you can see why his blood used to boil when he talked about the Pistons.
We're talking to Judge Blaha, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to the Golden Voice, who in 2010 was inducted into the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame. And in 2014, he was inducted to the Michigan Association of Broadcasters Hall of Fame. George, 1989, a guy from Lithuania, Sarunas Marcialonis, comes into the NBA, revolutionizes the game. At the start of this season, The NBA's rosters featured 108 international players from 42 countries and territories. Talk about how the international players have revolutionized it.
Well, somewhere David Stern is smiling because his goal was to make professional basketball, basketball as a game, and NBA basketball a worldwide game with fans everywhere. And he's done that, clearly. These kids don't grow up wanting to be basketball players if they don't have some connection to the NBA game. And now, guys come from all over the world. We just celebrated LeBron James entering the 30,000-point club, 30,000 points in his career. And one of the other gentlemen on that list is Dirk Nowitzki from Germany. And there still have only been two, maybe three players from Germany in the NBA. But Dirk is clearly the greatest international player. And he's been marvelous to watch. And but I don't think any of that happens if David Stern doesn't push to find ways to connect the NBA to the rest of the world. And he did that. And the fruits of his labor are coming back to the NBA. These guys have made it a better game.
I butchered Saronis' last name. I'm not even going to attempt this next name. But the Milwaukee Bucks, have a 23-year-old. All right? We call him the Greek Freak.
Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Easy for you to say, George. Say that again.
Giannis Antetokounmpo.
I think that guy would be worth 200 points in Scrabble if you could think of talk about him.
Well, I remember asking some NBA coaches about him when he first came into the league. And, yeah, they do call him the Greek Freak. I think when he came into the NBA, he was 6'9". Now he's about 6'11". And he has unbelievably long strides. He can soar. And now he can shoot the ball. And he has a bit of that international feel for the game, meaning he can and will pass the ball. So the guy, I believe, someday will be a most valuable player in our league. He's on the short list of the guys who are maybe in the waiting room, but he'll be there. And he's a pleasure to watch. You got to come down and see us when Milwaukee comes to town.
All right. April 10th, 2017, the last Pistons game at the Palace. As you walked out of that palace that night, what were your thoughts?
Well, as I walked in, I was emotional. During the night, I was emotional. And as I left, I was sad. That building, a magnificent building. The only building that could have been there for that many years, 30-plus, and still looked like it was brand new. Conceptually, it was fantastic. Designed for basketball. Tom Wilson, who was with the Pistons in those days, went all around North America checking out different buildings. And I believe it was the Saddle Dome in Calgary where he saw these suites that were closer to the court. So what a great idea. Bill Davidson agreed. Bill Davidson and some of his friends put up their own money, built the palace, cared for it like it was their garden. You know, it was always pruned and watered and taken care of like it was one of their children. And we loved it there. And it was built for basketball, great sight lines for basketball. The Bad Boys won championships there. Ben Wallace and the Going to Work group did with Chauncey and the rest. And those are memories that no one can ever take away from us. But I think moving downtown was a great thing for Detroit. And those of us who live in the Detroit area or anywhere in Michigan have to understand if it's good for Detroit, it's good for all of us.
30-plus years later, Tom Wilson gets the chance to do it again, this time with the Ilitch family, goes all around the country, and we're the beneficiaries of the Little Caesars Arena. Talk about that.
People love Little Caesars in terms of the amenities and everything that's available there. It's a wonderful building. I love where it's located. And I love the fact that we're now the only city in America that has all four sports teams downtown and within a block or two of one another. They have their teams all together in Philadelphia, but they're in South Philly, a number of miles from downtown Philadelphia. Right now, Little Caesars Arena is probably going to be the springboard for even greater resurgence in our area.
What's the one or two biggest things, George, that all of these phenomenal athletes over the last 40-plus years have taught you?
First of all, they're all human. They all have feelings. You know, if you cut them, they'll probably bleed. They're not robots, and they need your understanding just like anybody else does. And they're also, in every case, people who had a dream and followed their dream. You don't become an accomplished basketball player or football player without working at it. And I know some people have a great deal of natural ability, but there are an awful lot of people with a great deal of natural ability who aren't in the NBA or aren't playing major college football or NFL football or doing anything else at the level they want to be because they didn't work hard enough at it or they didn't have the chance to work hard enough at it. I don't mean to disparage anybody who didn't make it because sometimes they're extenuating circumstances, but I believe that if you love something and you want to go after it, you should. Follow your dream because, Jack, don't forget, anything is possible.
George Blaha, you and I are two shining examples of that.
Isn't that the truth?
Keep up the great, great work.
Thank you, Jack. Love being on with you.
Thank you. Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening and make it a great week because with God, anything is possible. Spoken.